Fry had changed careers, as he put it. He was originally in the English department at Stony Brook and did some administrative work.
Let's start the story over.
Okay.
This is Don Fry. The question is, why did I come to Clare? This is a man named Roy Clark. Graduated in about 1975 and went to Auburn to teach
Chaucer.
Yes, in English. Wrote a dissertation on Chaucer. And while there, he wrote an article for the op-ed page of the New York Times, which was such a smash that some local journalists befriended him. And they recommended him to Gene Patterson, who was the head of the St. Petersburg Times. And Roy came here and worked for a while. And then they started up the Institute in 1978. The Institute is an advanced journalism school, improving newspapers in the area of writing, ethics, management, and graphics. So in 1980, when Roy started up his first seminars, which are a week long, he brought me down from Stony Brook to be the village idiot, somebody who knew nothing about journalism. And we did eight of those between 1980 and 1984. And I always had more fun at the Institute than I had at Stony Brook. I really enjoy it. And then one day, Roy said, I noticed a pattern, and that is that the best seminars are the ones that you're in. And I said, well, thank you very much. He said, no, it has nothing to do with you, but I'm better if you're around. And so that was the beginning of a partnership. And we negotiated, and I joined them in fall of 84.
84.
Mm-hmm. And so that's how it happened to be here.
I felt you're going with quite a loss on the humanities side.
Take it.
And I was curious.
I didn't leave Stony Brook out of distaste so much as I was attracted here.
Yeah.
But you see, I had always intended, Carl, to change profession.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't intend to be an English professor all my life. And I did it, in fact, a little later than I thought I would. I thought I would change professions at about 45.
Mm-hmm.
And I did when I was 48.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had originally thought that what I would probably do is go into university administration or government.
You tried your hand at it at Stony Brook.
Well, I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
No. And one of the advantages of coming here is that I don't have to help run the place. I can be a pure faculty member.
I see.
Whereas at Stony Brook, I didn't feel I could be a pure faculty member if this place was run so badly.
Okay, this was under... later years?
Well, I came to Stony Brook when John Hull was president, but
yes.
Let's see, Colby Neal was provost at the time it left.
I see.
And, I came to Stony Brook because I was approached by Irving Ritner, who was the chairman of the English department in 1969.
R-I-B-N-E-R.
He's a famous Shakespeare scholar. And I had a terrible falling out with the chairman at Virginia. He essentially decided that assistant professors were not going to teach seminars anymore. And I was brought to Virginia to teach seminars in medieval studies. And so I was very, very angry about that. And Stony Brook approached me and wanted if I wanted to come and be an associate professor. It was very late in the year, as a matter of fact. And one of my best friends, Robert Creed, was in the English department. And I thought, what a great idea to come and be Bob Creed's colleague, because we could really work together and do good things. And when I got there to interview, I discovered that it was his job I was interviewing for because he was going to UMass Amherst.
Yeah.
And Ritner, Ritner attracted me essentially with freedom. I wasn't particularly interested in salary or rank or tenure. They didn't strike me as terribly important. But what he offered me was the freedom to do what I pleased. I asked him what he wanted me to teach. He said, you can teach anything you want to as long as it's medieval. And what he really wanted me to do was kind of build a program. And oddly enough, that was what I was hired to do at Virginia. And by one chairman, and then the second chairman came in and pulled the rug out from under. And so I came up and started teaching Anglo-Saxon seminars again, which is what I wanted to do. And that was the bait, essentially, to let me come and design a program. And that year, he hired two other medievalists, Marty Stevens and Skip Shriver. And so all of a sudden, we had three brand new medievalists, and all pretty much the same quality, I think. And all of us with very similar ideas. And so we just threw out the old medieval program and instituted a whole new curriculum and so forth. And had some very good years of working together. But, and so I was interviewed for a position by Irving Ritner, and also representing administration, I was interviewed by Charlie Huffman, who was then an assistant to Sidney Gelmer. I'm not sure exactly what his title was. My understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook was the vision, not was the vision being transformed into reality. I was not particularly impressed with the material they handed out to me, the article in Time magazine and all that sort of thing. I was much more impressed with the faculty and with their idea of undoing a lot of the traditional mistakes of the past, a lot of the rigidities of universities. And I was coming from Virginia, which is one of the most rigid of all American universities. I will remember a faculty meeting where at Virginia where we were considering doing away with the Latin requirement. And the people who wanted to do away with the Latin requirement
for the AB degree.
No, for the doctorate.
For the doctorate.
And the medievalists in the department wanted to do away with the requirement. My thinking was that students don't like anything that's required, so the way to get them to like medieval Latin was not to require it. And we thought that people who were likely to use Latin could be talked into learning it as a research tool, and that was a hurdle to jump on the way to a PhD. And the people in the 19th century in the department opposed it on the grounds that we might be criticized by Harvard if we did this. And in fact, Harvard had dropped its requirement the year before. And so it was a very traditional place. And the attraction of Stony Brook was that we were going to do things in new ways and get away from a lot of these traditions inherited from 19th century Germany, essentially. And to a certain extent, I think that worked for the first couple of years I was there. The difficulty was that the English department, which was essentially brand new, Irving Ritner hired 12 people the year he hired me, all with fairly advanced rank. And
Jason was no longer there.
We only left by 1 year.
And
I had known him previously, he was a friend of mine.
I was involved in bringing him in.
Yeah, that was a brilliant appointment.
I persuaded Dave Price, who was vice president for personnel up in the central office, that he was a man who was good enough. He already had an offer from Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to break the salary scale because Northwestern was offering him 20%.
Well, that's a good appointment. Casey was the best person in the news department at the time. And one of the attractions of Stonebrook was coming up to being his colleague. As I said, I'd known him before. He was a friend of my wife's family. And I had met him and talked to him, and I thought he was the best academic writer in America. And unfortunately, we only overlapped about a year.
I never knew why he left, except that he was really a New Yorker.
I think he left because the English department didn't make it easy for him to be lightly attached. When you have a star of that magnitude who wants to live somewhere else, and you find ways to accommodate him.
Yeah.
And they didn't treat him like a native faculty member. And that would have been an illusion to do so, but they should have done it. You accommodate a man of that quality. And eventually he got tired of the hassle, I think. I thought the division of Stonebrook lasted for about 4 or 5 years. There were several factors that made it stop. One was that the job market fell apart. The sense that there was no mobility after about 1972 in the humanities. And the other thing
was that
was a national market. For instance, in my field, Anglo-Saxon, nobody has moved at the full professor level in North America since 1972. Not a soul. And just no mobility at all. And the other thing that happened is that the English department completely redid itself the year I came. I had 12 new people, a whole lot of older, earlier faculty members, most of poets left. And
Simpson?
No, not Simpson. Harrison and people like that. And the department, instead of taking the high road and sort of undoing a lot of mistakes of English departments in the last 100 years, went the opposite direction. It became very traditional. The idea being that they were nervous about their credibility. And so when you're nervous about your credibility, you imitate the Ivy League. And at least you imitate some old-fashioned idea of the Ivy League. And so pretty soon the English department settled into a very, very traditional groove. And never went anywhere after that. The university, on the other hand, I thought was progressing in some very interesting ways. There were lots of new configurations. There were new types of departments. We made up all sorts of odd doctoral programs and stuff like that. A lot of freedom. And the humanities, on the other hand, were plagued by very poor leadership. And as a result, they ended up with third-rate chairs running the department, essentially. So the department has never turned things at all.
How do you account for the lack of leadership?
Well, I think there were two things. One was that the university style at that time, this is something I think John Toll brought in with him, was to go out and hire very high visibility scholars and make them chairs of departments and then pour money on them. And that worked where you hired the right people. And it didn't work spectacularly where you didn't. For instance, in the French department, they had 5 chairs in 4 years. Each brought in at very high salaries at the full professor level. And so, and each topped out after about a semester. So you ended up with a very top-heavy French department and no leadership, you see. And the other thing that I think was very damaging was the unfortunate tendency of Stony Brook to hire your friends. And particularly to hire them and keep them in leadership positions. I think that, for instance, the theater and art departments were hobbled for years by hiring friends. I think that really damaged the humanities very severely. It was a lot of fun trying to remake the university and trying to remake the English department and so forth. Remember that those were, the early 70s were years of great innovation in the country, American education. I thought we were in the right place to do it.
Yeah.
It just didn't work. Wrong people. You want me to go on with this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, my impressions of Stonebrook when I first came, the campus, the people, the leadership, and the spirit. The campus was a mess. We were still building it. The outer rim of the library had not been built yet. The bridge nowhere still stopped in midair and that sort of thing. And there was a lot of mud. 69, and it's all about the early 70s, they solved the mud problem. But there was a lot of problem parking and that kind of thing. The campus was ugly, very ugly, although the area was very beautiful. And the faculty was very young and very dynamic and very much committed to research and so forth, and had not yet divided itself into people who came early and people who came late. That was to come a couple of years later. And very exciting students.
You had good students?
I did, yes. Excellent students. And I would say that I had excellent students until sort of the late 70s. First-rate undergraduates. I would say with the graduate students, the top half were excellent, the other half were not. So very little middle ground. But I thought that the graduate students that I worked with at Stony Brook were fully as good as the ones at Virginia. And Virginia at that time was on its way to being probably the number three Ames department in the country, where it probably is now. The leadership, I thought, was quite mixed. I thought that the College of Arts and Sciences and the academic leadership was very poor, very weak, very much devoted to hiring friends, lots of favoritism, with very little vision outside of the music department. And I thought John Toll was a brilliant builder of buildings. But he had one unfortunate flaw, and that is that he never cared how people got along with each other. And he never cared about what people thought of the physical surroundings. He could never understand, for instance, that if life in the dorms was hard, that had an effect on the academic life of the students. And I remember several meetings just talking ourselves to a blue in the face to him about that, and getting absolutely nowhere. He just wasn't listening. On the other hand, he hired terrific faculty, he got the buildings up, and so forth. And I admired him for that. I worked with him a lot, and I think he did good things.
Yes, I think he was very good as a representative underneath of the institution to the central office.
Mm-hmm.
And even beyond.
But one thing that John has not gotten credit for that he should, and that's the library. We put a fortune into that library, and we built an excellent collection.
Yeah.
A very good base collection at a time when that was not easy to do. And John tends to get the credit for the library building, but in fact, it's the collection and the staff that was important. And that was done by just constantly arguing that the heart of the university is the faculty and the library. He really had his values straight in that sense. What events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind? When I first came to Stony Brook in 1969, the country was in the ferment of the 60s, and the people in Virginia thought I was crazy to go to such a nutty campus, because it was about 6 months after the drug bust of 68, and there was a lot of turmoil, and Stony Brook was known as a kind of radical school, which didn't bother me. I'd been at Berkeley in the early 60s. And also the free speech movement and so forth. And I remember one event that was very striking the first year I was there, probably the first semester. I was teaching a class, and there was some sort of demonstration going on the campus against the war. And suddenly a young man burst into my class and said, "This class is over." And we all looked at him somewhat shocked. And he said, "Everybody in here will go out into the community and talk to citizens about the Vietnam War." And I said to him, "Wait 1 second. We're going to take a vote." And I said, "The students will vote whether they're going to go with you or stay with me." And he was so dumbfounded by this that he just stood there speechless. And so I put the vote to the students, and they voted 100% for me and none for him. And it was a graduate medieval seminar, so that was a very likely thing for him to do. And he didn't know quite what to do. He wasn't expecting that reaction. So I told him to stand out in the hall until the class was over, and then I'd talk to him. And sure enough, for some reason, he was out there when I went out there. And the two of us sat down in the hall, leaning against the wall, and talked for 2 hours. And I talked about what Berkeley was like in the 60s. And I talked about how the taxis he was using were not going to work. this kind of confrontation with the faculty was very old-fashioned. We knew how to handle it, and we did not win the hearts and minds of people by trying to throw them out of their classrooms. And it's interesting, he listened to that. I don't know what became of him. And that same year, we had some very strange events. The students were sitting in the library one night protesting something, and that was kind of in the front of my mind, and I was at home. I lived over on Parsons Road in Pawtucket. And all of a sudden, there were all these explosions in the direction of the university, and the whole sky was filled up with and blowing up and going. My wife and I ran out in the backyard, and we thought, oh my God, this is burning down the library. And it turned out that a paint factory, which was about a half mile from my house, had gone up in flames, and the explosions were from pressurized cans of spray paint. And they were going off like rockets. And it was interesting that the times were so strange that the first thing we think of is the students were burning down the library. And I remember once the chairman, Paul Bowman, called me up in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., and said, we're standing fire watches in the East Department building. I said, what for? He said, there are students who are threatening to burn it down, and we need you to come over here and help us. And I went over there, and we walked around in the building through the night, protecting against God knows what. Those were very strange days. Very strange days. What was the understanding of their own place in the future of Stony Brook? Why do you think you were appointed? I was appointed. I know I was appointed. I had a reputation as a person who had transformed the program at Virginia, even as an assistant professor. And Bob Creed, my friend, knew that. And he felt that the program at Stony Brook needed transforming. And he'd been trying to get Stony Brook to hire me all along. And I was brought there to put together a new doctoral program and to teach in it and so forth. But that really wasn't what I had in mind.
The department already had received permission to go with a PhD.
They already had a PhD.
You already had.
Yes.
I remember the first request of the department to go that way. And I set up an outside review committee.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Nicholson. The man looking at the library collection was the librarian.
And one of the nice things about it was lower operating levels. And so it was a place where you get lots of experience. And I found myself as sort of working up through a series of committee assignments and so forth, eventually becoming probably an officer in the English department of some sort, and eventually moving into the lower levels of the deanship and so forth. I did not expect to stay sober as long as I did. I thought I would move on faster, but as I said, the job market skidded to a halt. My expectations when I came were very high. The university had an enormous amount of money, enormous resources and great persuasive abilities, and was doing a lot of hiring. We had lots of money for attracting graduate students, and sort of wide open path for almost anything you wanted to do. But they had a kind of craziness about it. I mean, it was ready to try out new things. And there was also, I thought, a spirit of experimentation in the arts. And what I didn't realize is that the people who were doing that were leaving as I was arriving. So, the place had been a nest of poets before I got there. And unfortunately, all the poets, except for Louis Simpson, decamped as I arrived. That had nothing to do with my arrival. Have these expectations worked out both personally and for the institution? I think they didn't. In fact, I think Stony Brook, outside of biology and certain parts of the hard sciences, very quickly turned into a very traditional university.
Why?
Well, I think it had to do with the leadership, which was very timid. And once John Toll left, and I think it had to do with the problem of all the universities that were founded about that time. But they were all founded as experimental schools, essentially, and very hot in their ideas about how to do education and so on. And a part of the maturing process in such schools is that they get frightened.
Cooling off?
Well, it isn't a cooling off. It's suddenly you get respectable. Something like that. And I think that had a lot to do with it. Plus, the country took a very conservative swing in the middle 70s.
And money became tight.
Yeah, you know, the money ran out. The leverage with the legislature ran out.
Well, when did Rockefeller die? We're going to be honest. I think
that in the late 70s.
Yes. But Kerry was a different mode.
Sure, he was not friends of the university, and the first major cutting came in 1975. And then there were very, very heavy cuts in 76, 77. And then after that, there was just one budget crisis after another. And I remember probably in any given year, there would be 2 weeks when we weren't in a budget crisis of some sort. And there was a lot of creative accounting and that sort of thing. The faculty was under constant threat of heavy cutting, 5% and 10%, tenured positions, whole departments going under, stuff like that. And it's kind of the craziness of the New York bureaucracy that there were ways to get around that. But it gave you absolutely no certainty about anything.
Right.
It was very hard to do any kind of long-range planning. You weren't sure who would be on the faculty the next year. And the Bureau of Budget, during the budget crunches, got very intrusive. And with controllable appropriated money by preventing it from being spent. Plus, I remember one period when the Bureau of the Budget sent down a very innocuous memo saying that all out-of-state travel had to be approved in advance before the travel. The kind of thing expected of a big bureaucracy sooner or later. The difficulty was that they didn't approve anything. They would just drag their feet on it. And that meant that people going to conferences had to pay their own way. And the worst part of it was that it meant that candidates coming to be interviewed could not be reimbursed. And the state, the only state I've ever seen that defines out-of-state travel to include people coming to the state. And that kind of thing that made it very difficult to build any kind of programs to hire people from the outside and so forth. And I think that had a lot to do with it. Essentially, the state is...